But first today, how being hip and keeping up with popular culture has shaped the presidency and in turn shaped the nation. Presidents have been forced to calculate whether they want to be men of the people or men of somewhat higher understanding. Tevi Troy has written about this dilemma in What Jefferson Read, Ike Watched, and Obama Tweeted, 200 Years of Popular Culture in the White House. He's a past Deputy Director of Health and Human Services and a frequent television and radio analyst. He speaks at the Kansas City Public Library tonight. And Tevi, welcome. So good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Well, how would you compare, you know, President Obama's ties to popular culture to George Washington's, going all the way back?
Well, it's a good question, and I think it's important to go all the way back because every president has had to be aware and conscious of the popular culture. That's the way you win the will of the people.
Did George Washington sort of intuitively understand that even back in the day?
Well, you have to remember that back in the day, there were only a few modes of popular culture. There was the written word, or books, and then there was live theater, live entertainment. And so Washington had a library of about 900 books, which is huge at the time. Harvard College is named after John Harvard, who gave 400 books to the small college of in Cambridge, and he got the whole school named after him. Washington also was a big fan of theater, and he showed a play called Addison's Cato to the chiefs at Valley Forge in order to keep up their morale in that very difficult winter. So he was very aware of what's known as the theatricality of leadership, of how to use cultural messages and themes in order to get the people on your side and to get the soldiers on your side.
And didn't he use some of those themes and ideas he got from popular culture almost to save his own generalship at one point? The soldiers were talking about mutiny, and Washington had to weigh in at one point.
Great story. At Newburgh in 1783, there was talk about a mutiny because the soldiers feared they weren't getting paid. And Washington got up and gave a speech in which he used lines from Addison's Cato to kind of quell the rebellion. But he also famously rustled his papers when he put them down, put on his glasses, and said, "Gentlemen, you will forgive me as I have not only gone gray but also blind in service to my country."
Yeah, what a great line.
At that moment, the air went out of the rebellion like a leak in a balloon.
I read that in your book, and I thought that is just the perfect line at a moment like that when the men are growing restless. Well, fast forward to President Obama. How has he used popular culture? Because obviously the array of choices before him vastly exceeds what was before General Washington.
President Obama, I call a pop culture omnivore. He's interested in all forms of popular culture. He talks in his own book, his first memoir, about his time in Hawaii growing up. When he would leave school, he would go to the comic book store. Then he would go home and watch cartoons. Then he would watch sitcom reruns. Then he would watch primetime TV with his grandfather until his grandfather kicked him out of the room to watch Johnny Carson. And then he would listen to Top 40 radio until he fell asleep. So that's taking it all in. And he uses his knowledge of pop culture in order to advance his political goals. He meets with Hollywood celebrities. He makes jokes about Hollywood shows. There was a time when he was briefed about a possible Islamic sleeper cell in the U.S. And he said, "Oh, sounds like Homeland."
just like that, right? Well, why focus on presidents and popular culture? Why that connection?
Well, the president is the most important person in the nation and sets the tone in so many ways. At the same time, they can't be too far out there. So you're not going to have a president in 1960, let's say, embracing rock and roll. And John F. Kennedy and LBJ did not embrace rock and roll. But when the culture catches up, then it becomes safe for the president to use it for their electoral advantage. So let's say in 1992, when Bill Clinton uses the song "Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow," the Fleetwood Mac song, as a theme for his campaign, and that really resonated with the baby boomer generation, and George H.W. Bush seemed a little out of touch with the younger baby boomers because he was not so comfortable with rock music.
I was going to say, so you're saying you can't get too out in front, and you certainly can't get too far behind. You mentioned George H.W. Bush, and one of the defining moments of his presidency, rightly or wrongly, and perhaps wrongly, was that moment where he was at the supermarket and didn't recognize the electronic scanner, wanted to know what that was. I think it's fair to say that story has sort of been debunked over the years, but having said that, that was the image that got cast, and it really hurt him.
You're exactly right, Steve. The point is the image got debunked, but it didn't matter. Once it got out there that President Bush didn't know what a supermarket scanner was and every American goes to the supermarket every day and they know how to scan their groceries, then it seemed like he was hopelessly out of touch and it couldn't be fixed.
So what's the sweet spot then? If you can't get too out in front and you can't get too far behind, you've got to appear to be with it, but maybe not too with it? Or what's the magic formula here?
That's exactly the point of the book, that presidents are trying to manage this dichotomy, if you will, of being men of the people and being able to speak to the people about shows that the people watch and enjoy and the president watches, but also being above the people and being a man of higher wisdom and understanding. That's why so many presidents rely on reading. They show that they're reading biographies or serious works of history to show that they are keeping up with what's going on contemporaneously, but they're also thoughtful and wise individuals.
Yeah, that's exactly – reading is the perfect thing, it strikes me, now to hear you describe that, Tevi, because I mentioned at the top of the show there's this need for a president to connect with the average citizen out there, but they also want to be men of higher understanding, and reading sort of hits that pretty well.
It usually does, not always. I mean, the average American only reads about one book a year, so you can't rely too much on reading, and that's why sometimes presidents go to popular TV shows. President Obama has been very good at using TV. He mentioned
the
late night
comedy shows. Yeah,
well, yeah. I mean, that's an excellent point. He's the first president to go on a late night comedy show as president. Never happened before. And in fact, I just read this book about it. It says that Bill Clinton was the first political guest of any kind on the Johnny Carson show. He was governor of Arkansas at the time. It had never before happened that Johnny Carson hosted a political guest.
So why do you think Barack Obama went on, was it Leno's show?
Leno was the first.
Yeah, why did he do it?
Well, what happens is as a political candidate, you have to run this gauntlet of the late night talk show hosts. And that also is something that was led off by Clinton in 1992. He went on the Arsenio Hall show and he played the saxophone. He put on sunglasses. He appeared cool. And then people forget this, but he sat down and talked to Arsenio for about a half hour in a way that presidential candidates had never done before. So when Richard Nixon, for example, went on Laugh-In in 1968, he only appeared long enough to say the show's signature line, "Sock it to me." And that was it. But Obama has recognized the importance of these shows. In many ways, they're more important than the news. They get a lot more viewers. And in many ways, it can also blunt the attacks from the late-night comics. There's been some research that shows that President Obama has actually gotten off kind of light from the attacks by the late-night comics relative to other presidents.
Oh, that's interesting. We're visiting with Tevi Troy about his new book, What Jefferson Read, Ike Watched, and Obama Tweeted, 200 Years of Popular Culture in the White House. And that's exactly what our conversation is about this morning. If you want to join it, 816-235-2888 is our phone number. Again, 816-235-2888. And Tevi speaks tonight at 6:30 at the Plaza Branch at the Kansas City Public Library. To RSVP and to grab a seat, just go to kclibrary.org. How did you get started on this topic? What drew you to it?
Well, I have a somewhat unique background in that I have a PhD from the University of Texas, where I did my dissertation on presidential history, and I looked at intellectuals in the White House. And then I worked in the White House at senior levels. So I have this combination of both having worked there and knowing what the White House works like from the inside, but also having studied as an academic. And what really fascinates me is what influences presidents. How does something happen on a policy level? And I started to look at books presidents had read that shaped what their policies were. So, for example, Teddy Roosevelt, who would read 2 to 3 books a night, I'm serious, 2 to 3 books a night while serving as president, he read Upton Sinclair's The Jungle about the horrific practices in meatpacking plants, and that encouraged him to go on this effort to start the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration. So I was really interested in what influences presidents, and I realized it was more than just reading, so I started looking at theater and movies and TV and radio, and that's how the book came together.
You know, it's interesting to me about images and how we think of our presidents, Tevi. You look at President George W. Bush, the second Bush president, who read tons of books, way, way, way more than the average American. And yet he was viewed as somebody who had never seen a book in his life. And I'm wondering, how did that happen? And how did the White House try to counter that image?
Yeah, well, there's a great story there, and it's actually partially Bush's fault. He lost an election in 1978 to a guy named Kent Hance, and Kent Hance derided Bush in East Texas as a kind of pointy-headed, liberal, Northeasterner who went to Ivy League schools, which is true. He went to both Harvard and Yale, the only president to do so. And so he ridiculed Bush as this outsider telling us what to do and this kind of intellectual figure. And Bush said after that he would never be out-countryed again. And he put on the leather jacket and the jeans and the cowboy hat and the swagger. And he was very successful in becoming governor of Texas twice and becoming president twice. At the same time, once you have that reputation, like we were talking about with his father in the supermarket scanner, it's very hard to undo a reputation, to change a reputation once you're introduced on the national stage. And so Bush would read 60 to 90 serious books a year. He read history and biography, but he never got credit for it. He was always seen as this kind of swaggering Texan cowboy.
60 to 90 books a year, that's a lot of books for a guy as busy as a president of the United States.
It's true, but if you think about it, he has no commute. He doesn't have to wash the dishes. He doesn't have to take out the garbage. The evenings, if you're not at a political fundraiser, and you know, President Obama is setting records for being at a political fundraiser, but you know, if you're not at a fundraiser every single night, you have time to do that sort of stuff. And different presidents like to use the leisure time in different ways. President Obama, for example, watches a lot of TV. Bush would like to read. Bill Clinton did everything, but he also he especially liked movies. And so they do have time to do these things in the evening.
Well, let's talk about the history of this country, because certainly our early presidents, Tavi, had this reputation of being not so much men of the people, but men of higher understanding, to use your words. So as you look at the arc of history with the presidents, when did that begin to change, this sense of presidents as being aloof and removed from the people, like Washington and a Jefferson versus a Bill Clinton many years later?
In the book, I actually identify the exact moment. It was in the elections between 1824 and 1828. Both of those elections pitted John Quincy Adams, who was a real intellectual, knew Greek and Latin, had gone to Harvard, was a huge reader, against Andrew Jackson, mm-hmm. who was a real populist, a man of the people. People joked that he could barely spell, and it was true. Read very few books in his life. But he knew how to relate to the people. Now, Jackson lost that 1824 election, but he won a plurality of both the electoral and popular vote. He just lost it in the House of Representatives. And by 1828, his populism was more successful and he won a stronger majority of both the electoral and popular vote. And he became a two-term president.
That's interesting. Americans and popular culture, that's our topic today. Let's go to some phone calls at 816-235-2888 or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Joe from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was wondering where President Obama kind of ranked as far as involvement in pop culture among all of the presidents. I mean, would he be considered more popular or less popular or more like in the public eye than other presidents have been in the past?
Oh, he's definitely at the top of the list. And he has been brilliant at his use of popular culture in getting political advantage from it. He has 40 million followers on his Twitter feed. And that's a growing number, so don't hold me to the exact number because that changes all the time, but it's always going up. And that's more people than listen to the State of the Union address or watch the State of the Union address, which is about 30-odd million people. So he also references TV shows frequently, not just the Homeland thing I mentioned earlier, but he's often making jokes or allusions to TV shows. He talks about movies. He has movie stars not only into the White House, but they go out, they campaign for him, and they raise money for him. He goes on the late-night talk shows, as we discussed. So he is really very immersed in the popular culture, and he uses his knowledge of the pop culture to connect to the people in a very effective way.
Hmm. What do you think, Joe?
Sounds great. I agree totally.
Yeah, appreciate the phone call. Thanks for making the effort. You know, one interesting case study here, you mentioned, you know, we're talking about George W. Bush reading so many books. Jimmy Carter watched movies like crazy. I didn't realize that about him. What was it about President Carter and movies?
Carter watched something like 2 to 3 movies a week when he was in the White House, which is really a huge number, especially considering what was going on at the country at the time. It was a very difficult time with the energy crisis and poor economy and trouble abroad with the Soviet Union and Iran. But Carter was, if you read Carter's diaries, he really is looking for ways to connect to the people, to find a way to figure out what was going on in the culture and to be able to identify something about what was going on. And so Carter really had this conscious effort to figure out what he could learn about America from the movies. It's almost like an outsider watching. And when he started as president, he said that over the last 2 years when he had been running for president, he didn't get a chance to see any movies. And so he told his media advisor, Gerald Rafshoon, we're going to catch up. We've got this great theater. We can see any movie we want. This is before people had home theaters and DVDs. It was a big deal to be able to bring movies into your house, and they bring it into the White House. And he brought over 250 movies into the White House in his one term.
It's also interesting to me, speaking of President Carter, one interesting case study out of all this was Carter's Malaise speech. You note that the topic came from an academic article, and people at the time responded pretty positively when he first gave it, but ultimately the speech would go on to tarnish his image. Is this a case where better understanding of popular culture could have led to something a little bit more effective when it came to policy itself?
Yeah, it's a good question. He did relate to this academic book by Christopher Lash, and Lash's book was a major and surprise bestseller of the time. And one of Carter's political advisors latched onto the book and talked about it in the 75-page unending memo that they made fun in the White House because it was so long. But it really highlighted this book and said, this is how you can connect to the American people. And the book did talk about a sense of malaise. Now, when Carter gave the speech, he did not actually use the word malaise. But Ted Kennedy, who was running against him for the Democratic nomination, remember, a sitting president challenged within his own party, Ted Kennedy called it the malaise speech. And that's when the unpopularity of the speech began to emerge, and it became a symbol of the ineffectiveness of the Carter presidency.
You know, we've been talking, you know, so far, Tevi, about this idea that presidents try to glean clues from popular culture to help their presidencies. What about flipping it a little bit and looking at it from the opposite viewpoint, which is how popular culture begins to reflect something from the president himself? I'm thinking about these you know, bombastic, patriotic movies like Rambo 3, Rocky 4, and Top Gun that came out in the era of Ronald Reagan, who was, you know, very big on pro-America and patriotism, that kind of thing. What do you see when you flip the equation a little bit?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, the 80s were kind of a time of go-go patriotism, and Reagan certainly encouraged that. And I think the movies reflected that tone that he set in these movies that you're talking about, the Rambos and the Rocky, especially Rocky IV, which is just this big patriotic, let's beat the Soviet Union in the Cold War type movie. And so Reagan, I think understood the culture, and in the when Carter was watching those kind of depressing movies of the 70s, Reagan was looking for more positive messages from the movies, and they actually disagreed about the movie The Deer Hunter because Carter saw it as this kind of fitting into his view of the malaise of the world, and Reagan looked at the patriotic images of these people who had served in Vietnam and then were having a tough time when they came back home. And so I think Reagan understood the American psyche as reflected in Hollywood better than Carter did, and then it became part of the symbolism of his decade.
Yeah, I'm also wondering, as you look at this topic, how much more difficult it's become for presidents to connect to popular culture at a time, you know, in the internet era when we are segmented in our society in so many, you know, in such smaller populations than we used to have. There's so many different TV channels, so many movies, different kinds of movies, so much more music, independent music, all these different genres of that. How much more difficult is it now for a president to connect when there's so much more out there and audiences are going in so many different directions?
Well, it's hard to give one speech or have one appearance that everybody sees. But the segmentation is also an advantage to a president, and President Obama has used this very effectively. He goes and gives the messages he wants to the audiences who are best tailored to hear that. So he speaks to women when he goes on The View, and he's gone on The View about 6 or 7 times. And he speaks to young voters when he does the slow jamming of the news with Jimmy Fallon. And so he speaks to Hispanic voters when he goes on Univision. So he knows where he's speaking, he knows the audience to whom he's speaking, and he knows what messages work best in those venues. And so he's used audience segmentation not as a disadvantage. You know, it's true you can't go on Walter Cronkite and get 60 million viewers anymore, but he knows how to find the viewers that he needs and tell them what they want to hear.
Who do you think was the clumsiest president when it came to navigating this idea of popular culture?
Oh, it's such a great question. There's so many good examples, but but I think Richard Nixon was just hopelessly out of touch when it came to popular culture. I mean, he would say these terrible things on the White House tapes about Jews running Hollywood and possible ways that they might want to go after Hollywood because of the relentless liberalism from Hollywood. And he also, the problem with Nixon is that he thought he was very good on TV based on the famous Checkers speech in 1952, when he saved his career by giving this maudlin speech about the dog Checkers that he got from a political contributor. And he said, no matter what, they weren't going to give that back. Well, in 1952, big hit, and it saved his political career. But in 1960, he didn't understand the medium of television and did quite poorly on it in the debate with John F. Kennedy. Mm-hmm. And in the Watergate era, he really didn't understand how to convey his messages. Obviously, the substance was against him, too, because he had participated in this terrible cover-up. But he really didn't understand how to push back in the media era.
And even when you talk about President Nixon, that little cameo appearance he made on Laugh-In, it just seems so incredibly out of place that maybe people just gave him a little credit for just trying it to begin with, because it's such a juxtaposition of two different worlds colliding very suddenly there.
Yeah, the truth is that the Laugh-In appearance was very helpful to him, and it kind of shaped this image of the new Nixon, and it really did help him in that 68 campaign. And he hired a TV savvy guy named Roger Ailes to be his TV advisor for that 68 campaign. Ailes was a producer on the Mike Douglas show, and Nixon went on the show and made some derisive comment about TV, and Ailes said to him, if you don't understand TV, you'll never get elected. And then Nixon hired Ailes, and Ailes went on to, obviously, this huge career.
Tevye Troy's new book is What Jefferson Read, Ike Watched, and Obama Tweeted, 200 Years of Popular Culture in the White House. He'll be speaking tonight at 6:30 at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City Public Library. To grab a seat, just go to kclibrary.org. And Tevye, I sure enjoyed having you here. Good luck with
great.
More books, okay?
Thanks a lot.
You bet.